I knew a lot about Larry before I actually met him and knew him. He was good friends with my best friend, who's a fellow named Keith. And Keith, anybody that Keith thought a lot of, was a fine man. I mean, more than just somebody who talks a lot and is out there and is known. It's somebody who does a lot of work. The big book says on page 83 that our own behavior will show them more than our words. And I know Larry's sponsor, and Larry's sponsor is one of those type of people. But Larry is a guy who, whenever something needed to be done over in the Texas area where he was living before he moved back on this side of the country, he was the guy that I was referred to ask questions about it. When I was delegate here about 12 years ago, I had some real problems I couldn't ask anybody in this area about. And I asked Larry, and Larry helped me solve those problems. And he's been a good friend ever since. And those of you who know that I went through a disease called esophageal cancer, and I had I'm kind of a miracle that I'm here. Larry's about to be one of those miracles. He's going to have an operation similar to mine. He has esophageal cancer, and that operation will be this Monday. So I'd like for everybody to be praying for him on that day. And so we can hear his story and hear what God has done for him. Please help me welcome Larry from Inman, South Carolina.
That's the first time I've ever been wired and I didn't feel anything. I'm Larry Johnson, an alcoholic.
Hi, Larry.
And it's an honor and a privilege to be here at the Macklin Group to join you and celebrating your 15th anniversary, 15 years of service to Alcoholics Anonymous in your community and the surrounding communities here in the Atlanta area. And I want to say thank you so much. I want to thank my friend Dick for having me come down and providing some top-notch accommodations. I appreciate that. And I fell up in, I think it was in Las Vegas sometime back, was getting ready to speak. And he said, I don't know where to start. And somebody in the back of the room said, start somewhere toward the end. And so maybe that's what I ought to do. I want to thank Dick for the nice introduction. I've been introduced in many different ways around the country, and I think the most memorable one is the lady said that some of us have heard Larry and some of us have not, and those of us who have not are looking forward to hearing him now. It takes a minute, and we get it. I don't have time to do any monologues, and thank goodness I don't, because I don't do very well in that area. As Angie read in our book, from the book, a while back, just a couple of days ago, it seems like to some of y'all, our story is disclosed in a general way what we were like and what happened and what we're like now. And we can all be thankful for that line in the book, that it's in a general way. If it were not in a general way, we could go to a conference or something and you wouldn't have but one speaker, because it'd take the whole time for them to tell the whole story. So you'll know more about me when I leave here tonight than you did before I got here. And my story is not so different than any other alcoholic. You may, if you're here and you're new, please do yourself a favor and don't compare your story to mine. If you find some similarities in it, just embrace those similarities. In 1970, I was a so-called volunteer in one of Texas' finer mental institutions called the Turtle State Hospital. And congratulations on 19 days. I told Doug, when I had 19 days, I was in a nut house. So you're doing a lot better than I was doing in 19 days. And welcome, and so was Doug. He was there a lot longer than that. He was there a lot longer than I was. But I remember I checked into that mental institution down in Terrell, Texas, and I agreed to stay 45 days. I'd had a kind of an epiphany over the past 24 to 48 hours that I might have a little problem with alcohol. But I wasn't an alcoholic, and I was pretty sure of that. And I went in on a Monday, and then on Tuesday of the following week, I had about all that place I could stand. I mean, 45 days seemed like an eternity to me, and I knew I wasn't going to stay 45 days. And I'll share this with you because it has significant meaning today for me and hopefully for someone else. Before I left, and even made the decision to leave that day, somebody said, everybody go upstairs to the recreation room. And so we all went up there, and they'd taken the ping pong table away and some of the other game things away. And they'd set up two circles of chairs. And the chairs were set up in just to complete circles. And there was an old gray-headed dude that was going to lead the meeting. Old guy. And white-haired guy. And he said, here's the first announcement was, he said, we're going to have a mock AA meeting. And I wouldn't have known the difference that day between a mock AA meeting and an AA meeting, but I have since learned the difference. And unfortunately, there are some look-alike meetings today. Earl H. up in Oklahoma City used to call them SS meetings or something similar. And my old sponsor, David A., called them BB. And I said, what's BB? He said, ain't AA. So he said, we'll have a mock AA meeting. And for all of those who want to participate in the meeting, take a seat on the inside circle of chairs. And those of you who do not care to participate, take a seat on the outside circle of chairs. So me and the other experts all sat on the outside circle. Me and a couple of my domino buddies. I'd been there 8 days, and all I had learned how to hold four dominoes in my hand at one time without dropping them. And that was meaningful to me, because I'd see people do that and envy people that could do that. Anyhow, so we sat, and what happened, we sat on the back row, and me and my buddy, critiqued everything that was said in that meeting. With things like, well, I haven't done anything like that. If I had, I sure wouldn't have told it. And one guy talked about drinking rubbing alcohol. And another guy talked about drinking Listerine. And I said, if I ever get that bad, I know that I belong here. But I've never done anything like that. Another guy talked about living in the weed patch. There's an area of Dallas, Texas that was known as the weed patch. I didn't know where it was at that morning. So what I did that morning was what I see a lot of folks do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and have watched this for a number of years now, sadly, watch this take place. See people sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and compare themselves out the door. So that morning, I compared myself out the door of that meeting, went downstairs and got my little suitcase and threw my belongings in it, stopped by the director's office and said, adios, I am out of here. I do not belong here. I am not like these people. And I left. I walked into Terrell, Texas, which is probably a 30-minute walk into the bus station. I had just enough money in my pocket to catch a bus to Dallas. And when I got off the bus in Dallas, I knew that my wife had enough money in her pocket to pay for me a cab home. So I hired a cab to get me home. And I don't know what she thought about all that. I really didn't ask her. I called her and told her I was coming. And I'd written her a letter a few days before that and told her how much I hated that place. So she wasn't surprised. The next 2 years, it was almost 2 years, it was some 22 or 23 months everything that I heard in that meeting that morning, everything that I had not done, happened to me. Everything that did not happen to me over the next 22, 23 months. I found that weed patch. I found out where that was at. And there was an old man, old white-haired dude. Well, you got to be careful with these old white-haired dudes, I got to tell you. Not the one that run the meeting. This was another fellow. I made a scene when I left. Now, I always liked it. I didn't make so much noise coming in, but I made a lot of noise going out. And I was making a lot of racket about what a horrible place that was. And you know how that goes. And this old man walked me to the door, and he had a lot of guts. And I don't have any problem talking to folks today about what he was talking to me about. Because he'll never know. I've never seen him since. But he took me by the arm before I walked out that door, and he said, Sonny, call me Sonny. And I was 31 years old and didn't appreciate being called Sonny. He said, Sonny, and I said, well, what is it, Pop? And he probably didn't enjoy that either. But he said, if I've ever seen a man that needed a drink, you need one. And I said, Pop, drinking is not my problem. He said, I know. If I've ever seen a man that needed a drink, it's you. He said, I've got a suggestion for you. I said, what is that? He said, when you get back to Dallas and you get a job and you get some money, what I suggest you do is go to the liquor store and buy you a bottle of whiskey and crawl in that bottle and stay in there till you can't stay in there any longer, and maybe the next time we see you, you'll be a little more like us. And I assured him that day that drinking was not my problem, and I left. And when I walked into the lobby of a place called Center Hospital on the morning of September 18th, 1972, if Pop had been there, I don't know but what I might have hugged his neck. I think he was one of the people that was instrumental in saving my life. Because I never, everything I did, I couldn't get what that guy said out of my mind. And I just want to share that with you, in particular for those of you who are new. Don't compare. Look for the similarities. That's what they told me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because our stories are going to be a little different. You might not have drank the way I did. You might not have drank what I did. That doesn't have anything to do with whether you're an alcoholic or not. It's not what you drink or when you drink. It's what happens to you when you drink that will determine whether you're alcoholic or not. Now, I was born at a very early age and raised in a Christian atmosphere in a little place called Rockingham, North Carolina. And I took my first drink when I was 15 years old, and I was a social drinker for about 15 or 20 minutes. And I never had any desire to drink like that again. And I drank for 5 years as much as I could, as often as I could. And then on the 5th day of July, 1959, I always like to say I quit drinking on the 5th day of July, 1959, and I stopped drinking on the 18th of September, 1972. It took me 13 years to stop after I quit. And I don't know how long it took you to stop after you quit. Some of the young folks are coming in Alcoholics Anonymous today. My friend here, I know that I've heard him, I've sat in a lot of meetings with Doug. And Doug, I've heard Doug share this, and I hope he doesn't mind me pointing him out. But I've heard Doug say this is really the first time I ever considered not drinking. So a real, like many of us, very fortunate man to be able to get it on his first try. But anyhow, at that July afternoon, I came to in my bed. Actually, my mama's. She owned everything in that house. And I was 20 years old. And I came to that afternoon and just kind of replayed what had happened the night before. I'd been in a bad car wreck. What could have been a lot worse wreck than it was. I won't go through all the details and all that of the wreck. But a buddy and I ended up hitting a semi head-on in a parking lot of a truck stop that 4th of July night. Fortunately for us, and to kind of dumb it down a little bit and take some of the drama out of that, that semi was parked at the fuel tanks. But one of my favorite people in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came in, and some of the older members will remember this guy, I don't know how you could have been around for any time at all and not have heard of him or heard him talk. It was a guy named Norm A. from California. He always talked about seconds and inches and timing being so important. And timing is critical. And if you, I often imagine on more than one occasion, looking back at that particular night, that had we been 5 minutes later getting to that place, there's a better and even chance that we'd have met that cat coming out of that truck stop rather than while he was finishing up fueling his truck up. So I ended up in the hospital that night sometime around 4:30 that morning. The doc decided that I was okay. I had a slight concussion. I'd been a little drunk. But I was. He said I'd be okay to go home. And then, I don't know if you ever had these experiences, but people say things, and then you hear things. Now, I've heard AA talks that wasn't even close to what the person was saying. It's just how I was translating it. But this doctor came up to me in the emergency room that morning and handed me a little paper cup with three little yellow tablets in it. And he said, here's what he said. He said, when you get home, you may have trouble sleeping. If you do, take one of these and it'll help you sleep. And I put them in my pocket, and my brother got me home, and I'm getting ready to go to bed, and I'm taking things out of my pocket, and I took that little cup out and then three little tablets in there. And then I remembered what that doctor said. The doctor said, you're going to have trouble sleeping. But if you'll take these pills, they'll help you sleep. And so I took all three of them, and they helped me sleep. And that's how I came to later that day in the afternoon. Now, I got to report to you, that's my drug story. I don't have any more to offer you. That's it. And I don't apologize for that. I'm not going to apologize for anything. And I'm not going to say anything that I need to apologize for. I think if you need to apologize for saying it, you shouldn't say it. It's just that simple. And so laying in that bed that afternoon, thinking about all that had happened that the night before and some other things that had taken place over the past, especially the past couple of years in my life, I surmised in my own mind, without any help from anybody, that I might have a little problem with drinking. And I was thinking about all the trouble I had, and then my next thought was probably the most intelligent thought I'd ever had up to that point in my life, and maybe since. And all the trouble that drinking had caused me. And this was a conscious thought that if drinking causes you that kind of trouble, you shouldn't drink. And I can't find anybody to disagree with that. And I thought, that's it. I just won't drink. Because every time I'd been in trouble, I'd been drinking. Didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but you can go ahead and believe that every time I got in trouble, I've been drinking. So I made a conscious decision that afternoon to stop drinking for the rest of my life. Now, I don't know about you, but when I just do something and decide to do something, to change something in my life that's not working, and that was certainly something in my life that wasn't working that day, and hadn't worked for a while, but I made that decision to do that, and I felt pretty good about that. I really got a good feeling from that yeah, this is a good thing. And people need to hear about this. And it's hard to find an alcoholic that'll do something like that and not have to go tell somebody. It's hard to keep, I don't know about you, I have trouble keeping stuff like that to myself. Because this is monumental. And the closest people to me, my mom and dad, I went in and I told them, and they were absolutely, as you might imagine, were absolutely delighted with this decision. And then they were having a revival down at the church, and we went down there the next night, and I got up in front of the church and told all them. And they came up and hugged and loved on us, kind of like AA, just didn't give out no chips or nothing. And they were all just pleased with my decision and welcomed me in to the fold. And I'd meet people on the street that I hadn't seen for a while, and I'd just tell everybody. About 3 weeks into that, I realized one day that I was 20 years old and I might live a while, and that seemed like an awfully long time to go without a drink. I met a girl, we got married, we courted for a while, and then we got married. We got married in the spring of 1960. I don't have any way of proving this, but I think the Secretary of War signed our marriage papers, because we got along well till we got married. And I thought I had just married the prettiest, sweetest little gal in Richmond County, North Carolina. And what I'd married was I'd married one of the prettiest and one of the meanest women that I'd ever known. She had a mean streak in her that I never saw until after we got married. And Betty would hit you. She hit me a lot, and I'm just assuming she'd hit you if you gave her cause. And I've been hit with a lot of things. I don't think any of us are unique, but I could be in a small minority of folks, of guys, that have been hit with a meatloaf. Now, the meatloaf doesn't do any real damage, but it makes a mess. She was making a meatloaf, and I said something she doesn't like, and I'm telling you, in about 2 seconds, I'm wearing that meatloaf. She had a little temper problem. Betty and I stayed married for 5 years, right at 5 years. And I don't know any two people that I've never met, any two people that tried harder at staying married than Betty and I did. The first night that I sat in the porch swing at her granddaddy's house, we sat in her granddaddy's porch swing that evening, on a summer evening, and right after I quit drinking. And one of the questions Betty asked me, she said, "Larry, do you drink?" And I said, "No," because I had quit. And she said, "Good." And I thought, that's it, that's the answer. I've been looking for that's a tough question for a drinking drunk, a drinking alcoholic. That's a tough question to answer. You know, do you drink? Well, yeah. Well, how much do you? Then the next question is, how much do you drink? And that's when you start lying. And when I start lying. But she said, I said, no. She said, that's good. I thought, that is my answer. I don't care who asked me. I don't care where I'm at when they ask me. That's my answer. Because that's a good answer. And she never pursued it any further. We didn't do any more. She didn't dig into any part of my life after that. And that's just been the way it is right up to this very minute. And I've had people ask me in the last few years, do you drink or you don't drink? I said, no, I don't. And I don't make any apologies for that. Don't make any excuses. I don't, you know, we don't wear badges around here or banners saying who I'm an alcoholic. We just don't do that. I'm not ashamed of the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I stand on my own 2 feet, and I will stand up for Alcoholics Anonymous under any conditions because of the lives that it saved. But anyhow, this no thing, I remember as a Dallas cop pulled me over. It's probably a year or so before I got sober. Pulled me over on the upper end of Gaston Avenue, one that's over in East Dallas. Pulled me over one late one Saturday night. He pulled me over and he came over to the car and he said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "No." And he opened the door of the car and I fell out into the street. And we gathered me up and got me kind of straightened back up. And he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "With you." That was usually the case. Betty and I, after 5 years of marriage, we had 2 children in that marriage, and I want to move along here as quick as I can. I talked slow. I've never talked fast. I lived in Dallas with a bunch of fast-talking dudes around there, but I just never did talk fast. And now I'm back in my country where we used to talking slow. And I've been wide open now ever since I started. But I got up one morning, I got up one morning and I threw some things in a suitcase, and Betty and I weren't doing well, and me and her mama wasn't doing well, and I had made a decision that I'd go up to Greensboro, North Carolina, and get a job, and this was my plan. I had a plan, always had a plan, and I wasn't drinking when this happened. Now, that I need to tell you, my first forever lasted 3 years. I went 3 years, never touched a drop. And then one afternoon, I made a mistake that many alcoholics like myself make. I was out one day by myself, and I started thinking. And don't do that. I started thinking about drinking, and the next thing you know, I had one in my hand. Anyhow, I quit again forever about 6 months after that, and then that forever lasted about a year and a half, and I hadn't had any more forevers since then. But I got to Greensboro, and I was interviewing for this job. It was in the retail furniture business, and that was something that I was familiar with. And I'd worked in and around that business for a couple of years. And the guy asked me a lot of questions. I answered all his questions, and I answered them correctly and timely. So it was a good interview. You know, that's what makes a good interview. You answer the questions without having to think much, and you do it in a timely manner. And so I knew I'd had a good interview, and I also felt pretty confident that if they were going to hire anybody, there wasn't any reason why they wouldn't hire me. And the guy asked me, after he got through, he pushed back from his desk, and his name was Ed. And he said, "Larry, I got one more question I got to ask you." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "No." He said, "Good. Well, I knew that." But I had never done a follow-up question from my end of the conversation. But I decided I'd do one that day. And I said, "Why did you ask me that?" He said, "I asked you that because the man that you're going to replace in our company is an alcoholic, and we're not hiring any more of those." And I said, "And I don't blame you. I wouldn't hire one of them either." He didn't ask me, but had he asked me, I'd give him a half a dozen good reasons why we should never hire alcoholics to work in our company. I mean, they just ain't no good. You know, they don't show up for work. I mean, I knew all about that kind of stuff. You know, thought. So the guy gave me the job, and I'm on this job about some 5 or 6 months. And by the way, Betty did not go along with the plan. She had another plan. Her plan was to go ahead and just get rid of me, and she was in the process of doing that. But I'm in there about 5 or 6 months on this job, and one Saturday afternoon, Ed comes out on the floor, on the showroom floor, and he said, "Larry, we're going to close at 5:30 today instead of 6, and we'd like for you to come down. J.D. and Will have gone down to the liquor store to get a bottle, and we're going to have a little drink after the meeting and come down and have a drink with us." I said, "Well, you know, Ed, I don't drink." He said, "I know you don't drink." He said, "Come down about 5:30 and have a drink with us." And I said, "Thank you." I said, again, I said, "You know, Ed, I don't drink, Ed." He said, "Son, I know you don't drink. We're just going to have a drink." And I thought, okay, I mean, what could that hurt? You know, it's been about a year and a half now since I'd had anything to drink. And I said, "All right, I'll see you at 5:30. So for the next 2 hours, that's all I can think about. That's all I can think about. It's already there. I'm a believer. You know, I submit certain ideas, and they're just mine. You take them or do what you want to with them. But I think in the many, many cases when an alcoholic, before they've already taken that drink before they ever pick it up. I think something clicks up in there, and the plan is there before they ever pick the drink up. My first sponsor told me that my problem, he said, "Today your problem's not drinking." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Are you drinking?" I said, "No." He said, "Do you want a drink?" And I said, "No." He said, "Then you don't have a drinking problem today, do you?" I said, "Well, I'm putting it that way, I guess not." I said, "If that's not my problem, what's my problem?" He said, "Your problem is you're thinking." And I said, "How much of my thinking do you think is bad?" He said, "I'm going to assume all of it, or you wouldn't be here." But that's all I could think about. And at 5:30, I show up down at the office. And there's Ed and J.D. and Will, and they're at the desk. And there's a chair for me. And on the middle, and there on the desk is some cups and some ice and some juice and a bottle. They bought a pint. And my first reaction to that was, "What are we going to do with this?" I mean, this guy wasn't kidding. We're just going to have a drink. And I did the math on that. I'm always doing the math. There's probably been many occasions when I'm the only guy in the room doing the math on that bottle. Because I'm never worried about the drink in my hand. I was always worried about where the next one was coming from. Supply was my concern. You know, I'd go to the liquor store to buy a bottle of whiskey and come out with a sack full. Because I'm so concerned about supply. And we didn't have much supply. And I did the math on that. That's 4 ounces apiece. And any third or fourth grader can take probably pre-kindergarten nowadays, as smart as kids are now. But I did the math on that. It's 4 ounces apiece if it's shared equally. And we knocked that bottle out. And so here's the upshot of that deal. Is Ed got in his car and went home to his family. Now, I didn't follow Ed. But I know that's what he did. It's what he always does. It's what he always did. And J.D. and Will got in their car and went home to their family. I didn't follow them either, but I know that's what they did because it's what they always did. And I left for California. Because that's what I do when I drink. Shortly after that event, a guy said, "Would you like to go to California?" And I said, "I am glad you asked me that. I have been wanting to go to California for years." Now, I got to tell you, in all honesty, I never really gave it any thought till he brought it up. But I'm a guy from that first, I shared in that first part, one of the first things I shared with you was I'm an easy target for the power of suggestion. The guy, he said, and I said, "Yeah, let's go." So we throwed some stuff in an old 57 Cadillac and away we went. And I wasn't unmindful of what I was doing. I wasn't unmindful of the fact, and this is a part of my story that I'm not proud of, and I carried a lot of shame about this for a lot of years, and rightly so. It's a word you don't hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, shame. But I had a lot of things in my life that I was ashamed of, and this is one of them. I was mindful of the fact that as I was leaving a woman who was divorcing me, and I was okay with that. But I was also leaving two small children. But I wasn't necessarily okay with that. But I had a plan. My plan was, we'll go to California and give me a couple of months. And a lot of us back in those days in the 60s, and there's some folks in the room that were around the 60s, you remember some of the stuff we were doing, especially the mid-60s, you know, and rock and roll was, you know, already in place, and a lot of different stuff coming. I think I always blamed on California, but now I've got to where it actually happens, but I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not. But many of us were trying to find ourselves. And that seemed to be the theme of that era in there for a few years in the 60s and maybe in the early 70s. Is everybody trying to find herself? Ain't nobody gone nowhere, but we're all looking for ourselves. And so after I get to California, and after I find myself, I get a job, make some money, a lot of money, because I'd heard people in California made lots of money. And I make a lot of money, and I go back, I come back to North Carolina, and I sit down with Betty and those kids, and I'd explain it to them. And I'd give them some money, and that'd make it all right. See, I was of the mind that money just fixes anything. In reality, money doesn't fix anything. Money is a kind of a necessary evil. We got to have it to get along. But that wasn't the way I thought back then. I'll get all this money together, and I'll sit down with Betty. I'll give her some money. She'll be fine. Well, we didn't make it to California, but we made it as far as Fort Worth, Texas. And we stopped in Fort Worth for 2 days. And some 47 years later, I moved back to the Carolinas. I made my first trip to California. That was in 1965. I did go to California in 1995. I attended the International Conference in San Diego, California in 1995. And I'll never forget that experience. I don't ever want, as long as I can breathe in and out, if they have to roll me into the stadium, I don't ever want to miss another Alcoholics Anonymous event like that. When you can see that much recovery, that much celebration, and the spiritual content of those big meetings are just, they're indescribable. I can remember standing on the floor of what was then Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego with my wife's hand in one hand and an AA member from somewhere in Montana in the other. And that thunder of the Our Father as it rolled across that stadium that Sunday morning. And great big real tears of gratitude and happiness rolled down not just my face but the faces of many. And I don't want to forget that. But that was, I finally did make California. Well, I ended up in Fort Worth. Fort Worth's a bad place to live, so I moved to Dallas. Dallas wasn't much better, but it was some better. And in the middle of January 1966, a buddy of mine, and I was selling cars, a buddy of mine I sold cars with, called me off the side one day. He said, I date a girl that works for the phone company. She's got a girlfriend. She's not tied up right now, and just wonder if maybe you'd like to have her phone number. You can call her. And we've told her a little bit about you, and if you can give her a call and maybe set up a date, and we can all go out on a Saturday night here pretty quick. Sound like a good plan to me, so I call this gal, and we talk for a while. And when she tells these stories, we lied to each other for a few days before we ever met, you know. But then we went out on our first date on a Saturday night, and I think she thought we were going to dinner. But I don't go to dinner in them days. Dinner was not even on the, I wasn't even on the plan. We're going to a bar somewhere where they maybe got some music and we're going to have a good time. So we went out to a club and then we started to dating. And I wish I could tell you that we had a beautiful courtship for the next 16 or 17 months, but our courtship didn't start until after I was sober probably 4 or 5 years. Is when our courtship actually started. And I've been trying to court my wife ever since, when I've learned how to do that. It was just an arrangement that we had. And I knew she was good people, and I knew that down in my heart that I loved this gal. And thought that she was probably a little more fond of me than she actually was. But so enough so that she became my ace in the hole. Every good alcoholic, every good drinking alcoholic needs an ace in the hole. Because you can get in a lot of jams out there and you need an ace in the hole to get you out of the jams. First time I got thrown into Dallas City Jail in the drunk tank, I called her. And I told her, I said, I'm in city jail and they got me in the drunk tank. I don't know why they put me in there. I ain't drunk. You know how that goes. We ain't never drunk in our mind. But I read today a guy sent me a deal. They're going to start having written sobriety field test. They just hand you, are you drunk? And you just check yes or no. Wish I'd done that when anyhow, I called Sam, and her nickname is Sam, and her given name is Anita, and it's just another story. But I called Sam, and I told her what was going on. I said, just take a few dollars to get me out in the morning. I get out at 7. The judge shows up at 7. They said I could get out at 7. Would you come down and help me out on this deal? And she said, yeah. And I loved to hear her tell that. She said that when I made that call, it just made her day. She said, oh, he needs me so much. And you need one of them. And so we started our training program for Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon probably that night. And she came down there. But I got to tell you this. I called. I thought, what if she don't come? Because you start thinking. A drunk's bad about thinking too much. But I started thinking, what if she doesn't come? But I knew another girl that might come. So I called her. And she said she'd be there. When I got off the elevator in the basement of that City Hall building the next morning, they were both there. And I just laid back. And I thought, I was going to let them work this out. And they got it worked out. And Sam took me home. And she was going to do that many times. She and I were married in May of 1967, and on the 27th of May, 1967, was a Saturday, And I know there's no such thing as an alcoholic wedding or alcohol, you know. We don't have a pamphlet on that. But if we ever get one, I think we're going to submit our story. And we're liable to get one. We got one on everything. Anyhow. I need to quit that. Somebody's going to turn me into New York. You ever been turned into New York? I've been turned in. I was in New York when a gal from my area, I was delegate at the time, turned me in while I was there. Jump up, Julie. Anyhow, I could quit that. Our wedding day went like this. At 7 o'clock that Saturday morning, Sam came down and got me out of jail. Now, that's the way you start a wedding, right? That's right. And on the way home, I said to her, you know what we should do? And she said, yeah, we should stop this nonsense. We need to get married and stop all this nonsense. Now, I can assure you that's not what I was going to say. I don't know what I was going to say, but it wasn't that. And I thought about what she said for a bit, and we'd talked about it some over the past few months. And I said, yeah, you're right. We need to do that. So we gathered up another couple and went up to Durant, Oklahoma that Saturday night and got married in the living room of a used car salesman in Durant, Oklahoma. And he was other things, too. He had the right credentials to do what he did. And we've been married ever since. Now, nobody really thought we'd stay married, but I'm going to describe what alcoholism looks like in a home. And this is just one incident. There were many, but this is one. And what I will describe to you is what alcoholism looks like. Alcoholism has a look about it. And it has sounds. And so does recovery. Recovery has a look. And recovery has sounds. There's nothing sweeter than the sound of recovery. There's no better place that I can think of to raise a child than a home where recovery is evident. And where two people have embraced a program that changed their lives. But alcoholism has a look, and this is what it looked like in my home this Sunday morning. I'd been out all night. It's the first time I'd stayed out all night. And I come home that Sunday morning, and when I opened that door, I knew that she'd be on the other side of that door. And she'd have a lot of questions for me. And when I opened the door, she wasn't there, so I went looking for her. And I found her in the bedroom lying on the bed. And in this keen alcoholic mind of mine, I'm thinking she's in bed. She wasn't in bed. She was on the bed. She hadn't been to bed. She'd been up all night. This was the first time I'd left her alone all night. And I walked in that room, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and she didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything. And I don't know how long I stood there. It seemed like a long time, but I'm sure it was just a matter of seconds. Because when you're staring, when you're looking into the face of someone who loves you and cares about you, and you're able to see in one facial expression every negative human emotion that somebody can muster up, you can't stay there very long. I don't know how long you can stay. I can't stay long. And I left the room, and I come back in the room, and in my thoughts coming back in the room was I just joined her in bed. So I go around, and I get into bed under the covers. When I got into bed, she got off the bed. When she got off the bed, she opened the drawer of her night table and extracted the .38 pistol. And I began now to watch her with great anticipation, as one might imagine. But nobody said anything. And then I thought, don't panic, that gun's not loaded. And she remembered the gun wasn't loaded, so she reaches back into the drawer and she takes out two rounds. She got two bullets, and she pushes the lever, the wheel drops open, she slides the bullets in there, closes it up and pulls the hammer back and lines one up with the firing pin. And I hear it click. And my only thought was somebody needs to create some kind of dialogue. It's just way too silent. And I was confused. I wasn't confused about what was about to take place. I get that. I understand, I've got that. This is it. I'm done. But I'm confused. What I was confused about was the two bullets. So my question, I had a question about that. I raised my hand. I'm sure I did. I don't know for sure. And she said she doesn't remember for sure, but I'm sure I did. Can I ask you a question? She said, yeah. I said, why did you just put two bullets in that gun? She said, before I answer that, I got to tell you, let me tell you something. I can't live like this. I refuse to live this way, Larry. I didn't sign up for all this. The dialogue was a lot longer than you might imagine. But the gist of the whole thing was, I can't live like this. And to answer your question, we are not going to live like this. And one of these bullets is for you, and the other one is for me. And I was able to talk her into putting that gun away. The first time she heard me tell that story, it was years in the program. And on the way home from meeting that night, she said, Larry, there's something I need to talk to you about. And God, I hate that. I still hate it today. We've been married 47 years. I still hate it. Oh, dear. I said, what's that? She said, well, it has to do with the talk you made tonight. And she said, in particular, the way you described that incident with that gun that Sunday morning. She said, I remember that almost precisely the way you described it. Well, I felt pretty good about that. But she said, there's something I've been wanting to tell you for years, and you've just opened the door, and you just gave me the best opportunity I'll ever have to tell you. And I said, what is it? And she said, well, I'm going to tell you the truth. And I said, and what is the truth? She said, Larry, the truth is that I never intended to use my bullet. And so... And AA, we call that ego deflation at depth. Now, as alcoholism began to take on a more frequent look and more disturbing things began to happen in our home, I lost my jobs. And September, the middle of September 1972, I was unemployed and unemployable. I had climbed the ladder of success, if you will, in the automobile business in Dallas, Texas. I managed two or three of the largest dealerships in the city before I was 30 years old. I keep dropping my, I don't have any. I got feeling in my fingers, I just can't feel these napkins. But now I'm unemployed and unemployable. And it's a Sunday night, it's the 17th of September, and I came to. I don't mean I woke up, I came to. I came out of a blackout. And I was lying in the middle of the floor, and I was looking up at her. She had moved our little daughter, Laurie, who was soon to be 2 years old, to the back of the house with her mother because I had not been very pretty that night, according to her. But I remember looking up at her, and I remember this as though it happened yesterday. And I hope it will always stay fresh in my memory. My early sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous encouraged me to hang on to that life-changing moment in my life. When I began this, something began to stir inside of me that I had not allowed to stir. And I knew down in the depth of my soul that life as I had been living life was over, that it no longer could I live this way, and I refused to live like this any longer. And I remember looking up at her and saying to her, Sam, I can't live like this. Would you please find me some help? And I was 33 and a half years old, and I'd never asked anybody to help me, no matter what my circumstances. But that night, that pain, it had gone down inside of me, and there was a little piece of me that nobody was ever allowed to touch. I think that God puts in every one of his kids, I think God puts a little piece of velvet down in there, and he places it down inside. And no matter how much booze we drink or dope we shoot or take or whatever you do with it, no matter what we do, he doesn't let that get soiled. And that night, that came alive down inside me, and I knew. I knew down in my knower. And she said, "Larry, who do you want me to call?" Now, I don't know who to call. This is a couple of years after I'd been down to the state hospital. And it didn't even dawn on me to call Alcoholics Anonymous. But the TV was on, and as I looked to my left and saw the TV on the TV screen was a commercial. And the commercial said across the top of the screen, it said the Center Hospital for the Treatment of Alcoholism. And the scene on the TV screen was a man, a woman, a little girl, and a bottle of booze. And at the bottom of the screen, it said, "If you've got a problem with alcohol, call this number." And so I said to her, "Call those people." And so she did. She made the call. 11 o'clock on Sunday night. And I knew there wouldn't anybody answer the phone. Nobody's going to be there at that time of the night. But a little nurse answered the phone, and nurse sensed the desperation in the voice on the other end of the phone, and she asked my wife, she said, "If you'll hang that phone up, I'll have someone call you in a couple of minutes." And she called the director of that place and got him out of bed. And I know that because I came to know him very well, and I knew his habits, and so I knew it's 11 o'clock on Sunday night, he's in bed. But she called him, she woke him up, and I don't know what she said to him, maybe something like this: "I just got a call. This lady sounds desperate. Would you please call her?" And so the guy called, and they talked, and they arranged for me to go see him. And the next morning, I'm in his office, and the interview was mostly with her. I'm the subject of the interview, but nobody's talking to me. And I listened and listened, and I heard him. He asked her, "You have your children?" "Yeah, we have a little girl." "Does he love that little girl?" And I said, "Of course I love my little girl." This guy's a real pro. He's never turned to me at all. He looked at her and said, "Does he love her enough to stop drinking?" And then I shut up because I didn't know. Well, I checked in to that hospital, and on the way up the elevator, I asked Tony, I said, "What's going to happen to me while I'm here?" And he said, "I don't know. You're required to stay here 28 days, and if you stay the 28 days, I don't know what's going to happen. What's going to happen to you while you're here is going to be up to you. What you do and what you put into this while you're here will determine what will happen to you while you're here. And what happened to me while I was there was," I think he asked me one day, he said, what's the one part of the program that you really like?" I said, "I like the Wednesday night gathering." He said, "That Wednesday night gathering is an AA meeting." I said, "Well, I like that. I like that meeting. I like what I'm hearing and what I hear in there." I met the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I met a man who came one Friday night and spoke to the group, and later that evening came up and did a 12-step call on me because I expressed some interest in what he had to say. And he came up after that meeting and spent 2 or 3 hours with me and another guy, and he laid out the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to us. And he asked me a question nobody had ever asked me before. He said, "Do you like being sober?" And I quickly answered, "Yes, I do." He said, "If you want to stay sober, I'll give you some things that you're going to have to do." He didn't say should do, ought to do. He said, "These are the things you're going to have to do." And he laid out a handful of things. He said, "When you leave here, the first thing you need to do is attach yourself to a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And get to as many meetings as you can get to. Read the book Alcoholics Anonymous every day. Get a sponsor and work with others. If you'll do those things, you never have to drink again." We're unthinking sometimes when we say to people who just as they come through the door, "You'll never have to drink again." But we don't tell them what the conditions are on that. But he laid out the conditions of that for me that night. And when I left there on my 28th day, I'll be honest with you, I did not want to leave. That's about as cushy as I'd ever had it. Well, you think about that. They cooked for me. They told me when to eat, when to meet, when to sleep, when to shut up, when to say something. I mean, it was just all done there for me. and she's home taking care of the home and paying the bills. I mean, I got it cushy. But they turned me back out into that cold world on that 28th day. That night, it was a Monday. I went in on a Monday, and I was released on a Monday. And that Monday night at 8 o'clock or about 7:45, we walked through the doors of the Suburban Group of Alcoholics Anonymous to that Monday night meeting, and she and her Al-Anon meeting, and we never looked back. Alcoholics Anonymous was without question the best thing that ever happened in my life. It has restored to me everything that I thought I had lost. Everything that I thought I had lost has been returned. I never thought I'd see my two children again because of my actions and what I had done. My 2 months turned in. I was over 7 years. I was gone over 7 years when I made my way into Alcoholics Anonymous. Without any contact. And I was 2 years sober. And I was struggling. Struggling with the steps. Struggling with recovery. Struggling to keep a job. Struggling with AA. And the reason I was struggling is I had some business that hadn't been cleaned up. When I worked with a lot of men over the years, and most times when one of them's struggling, they always wonder, what am I doing? And I always tell them, it's not what you're doing, it's what you're not doing. And I knew that I would never have any peace of mind till I cleaned this up. And I didn't. This was an amends I didn't think I could make. And I told my sponsor, I can't make this amends. It's just not going to be possible. And he said, nothing's impossible. Turn this over to God, go about your business, and you got a lot of work to do, and one day you'll know. And one morning, on the 17th of October, 1974, I picked up a little reader that's not conference approved, but neither am I. And people listen to me. And that just simply said that day, is there a letter I need to write? Is there a call I need to make? And I knew that day was the day. And I sat down at my desk that afternoon. I wrote Betty a letter. And I sealed it and I stamped it. And on the way home from work that afternoon, I dropped it in the mailbox. That was Thursday. And on Monday afternoon, my phone rang in my office at work because I'd left her every possible means of contacting me in that letter. And my phone rang, and the voice on the other end said, Larry, and I said, yeah. She said, this is Betty. And it seemed like time froze. And I didn't know what to say. I remember what I said. It couldn't have been any dumber, probably, but it was all I could do. I said, what's going on? <You know? laughs> Like we had just talked yesterday. She said, well, we got your letter. And we read it, and we wanted to call. I think the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot of power. If you knew, you may not have come up on it. The real power, all the power that's here. I think the most powerful steps are steps 8 and 9. To be able to make an amends where harm has been done, in some areas extensive harm, where people's lives have been disrupted and people have been denied. Those are tough amends, but they can be made. And we started that amends process that day. And 6 weeks after that, the woman who told me the last time I'd see her and those kids that I'd never see those kids again if she had anything to do with it, put those two children on a plane in Charlotte, North Carolina, and sent them to Dallas, Texas to spend Thanksgiving with their dad. The amends was in process. But someday, the letters are fine, but at some point, you got to come face to face. You got to get knee to knee, eyeball to eyeball, and make our direct amends. And an old friend of mine, and Dick's I know, and some others in the program, named Don P. from Denver, helped me with that as much as anybody. Don said that the true nature, he believed that the true nature of the ninth step was when you can stand in front of someone you brought harm to, and you can look them in the eye and say, what I have done is wrong, and I have wronged you, and I'm here today to get you to tell me what I need to do to square the books between you and I. And you tell me what to do, and I'll do it. When I said that to her, she said, I don't know, but I'll be back. I'll get back with you on that. And about 3 weeks later, I got a letter from her lawyer explaining exactly what I needed to do. Smart woman. Upset me. I called her up and fussed out. Well, smart. Best thing she could ever done. So I began to, I owed Betty 9 years of back child support. And it was 9 years later when our daughter, Kimberly, entered the university system in North Carolina in the fall. And that August 1st, I sent Betty a check. And it was the last one I would need to send because the debt was paid. The nature of the amends is important. It's more than just an apology or I'll try to do better. It's actually taking some real action and doing things that you don't want to do, things you didn't think you could do, and then after it's all said and done, you wouldn't have it any other way. And those relationships have healed over the years. A few Christmases ago, I'll just share a little bit of what it's been like. And I love family, I love my family, and I'm a family guy. A few years ago, we had the first of what's been many Christmases at Kimberly's home up in Davidson, North Carolina, where the family comes together on Christmas Eve and we have dinner and we do Christmas morning. And I looked around that Christmas morning a few years ago, and in that room were two of my children, three of my grandchildren, and all of my wives. And we were okay with each other. We were okay with each other. Powerful, powerful thing we have here. The miracle continues to go. And I don't, I'm not one of those people that I won't tell you that I am a miracle, but what I will tell you, and hopefully I can every time I tell you this or tell anyone this, I can do it with a grateful heart, that I am not the miracle, but I am part of one of the greatest miracles that's ever hit this planet. And it's called Alcoholics Anonymous, and a recipient of God's love and grace. Thank you for having me.